very much to all of you for this wonderful website that I get to subscribe to. This one is listed as a negative feedback. I just wanted to thank you for all of the literature you have sent me. I have so enjoyed working on the correspondence course especially, but the end threw me for a loop. I've been in God's church now for almost 36 years, so I've encountered bad things too. I'm not real smart, and I know that I don't think as deeply as I should concerning God's word. But I know that Christ lives in me and gives God's Spirit as I feel that I can say in love that you are mistaken about the other churches of God. I realize that some have made some mistakes, but the core still holds to what Mr. Armstrong taught. I myself have tried to hold to what I was taught when I first started attending. It changed my life and my family for good, for all of us. And it's still doing that today. God's people are scattered for sure, but He knows where we are, what we think, and what we are doing. So I'll thank you all. And as much as I have enjoyed your publication, I want to decline any more. Thank you so much. And again, that's from Maryland, obviously from the Laodicean. One more here on a little more positive note. From Washington. I recently moved and was worried about missing the latest Trumpet magazine. Then I remembered that it was online. I really think that most who have access to the internet should get their copy this way to save the work money. I will read all of the booklets and articles this way. By the way, the website is first class in its presentation. Keep up the hard work. But I wanted to talk to you. I thought I'd just talk to you about a subject, a forum that I gave to the students there. I guess there are a few students here, two or three or four, I don't know, that heard this forum, but I thought at least I've changed it somewhat, but it would apply to you and maybe be helpful to you as well as the students. And I might just introduce it by some of the comments I made at the commencement address, and these are just lessons I learned while at Ambassador College or related to Ambassador College when I went. But when you think about it, brethren, here we have education today, like it's really called the building block of civilization. And they are the architects of this society. That's essentially what it amounts to. So there is a lot at stake. And many people, not just a few, but many people are criticizing our educational system and saying, well, look, it's just chaotic. Something is terribly wrong with it. And our number one problem is that of human survival. Can you imagine that? Here we have the most educated people we've ever had, and yet our number one problem is that of human survival. Now, of course, all of that, those problems have emerged because we don't have that missing dimension in education. But do you think, when you look at that and consider that, do you think that educators of this world really have a responsibility for what we see around us? And I mean, you see a world full of evils. And you see a world where people are honestly fearful that we're going to erase all human life off this planet. Now that's just a reality. You know that as well as I do. That's what they're afraid of. And yet you won't hear higher education hardly even address that. It's usually somebody outside education. And I think that's rather sad because we feel, and have always felt, that this ought to be the chief concern of educators today. Well, if you can't show the people how to survive, what kind of education do you have anyhow? If we're all going to die, what's the point? And that's really what's going to happen if something doesn't stop that process. Harvard, you started out as a religious college, and a pretty good one as religious colleges go in this world. And today it's the world's richest university. Now, how would you like to go to college? It has the best label of any university perhaps in the world. But recently the president had to resign in a kind of a shameful way, and simply because the faculty kicked him out. And they say that that is a problem, not only in Harvard, but in most of our universities, that there's no president really in charge. The faculty rules, sometimes I suppose even the students to a great extent, but it's the faculty. And I wanted to just read you a comment about from Time Magazine, March 6, 2006, and this is an essay by Nicholas Lehman, and he said this: one of summer star faculty hires, psychologist Steven Pinker, told the Harvard Crimson just before the resignation announcement that he feared Summers was going to become like every other college president. Just a caretaker, a fundraiser, and a mouther of platitudes. Well, now, those are the words of somebody writing in Time magazine, and I happen to agree with that, and many other people agree with that as well. This is education in the world today. Well, what does a president do? Well, he gets up and he says what faculty members tell him to say. Where's the leadership? You know that you can't lead anything that way. I think most of us understand that. You just simply cannot do it. Is that true education? I'm going to read you a couple more comments because I thought they were good ones. This was from the Weekly Standard. And listen to this and compare it to Armstrong College today. Now, I think you can see when you understand this, we can see more clearly why God has us here as His teacher's college. We're going to teach Harvard how to be properly educated. And we're going to teach Yale and Princeton and all of those colleges that are so arrogant, certainly lacking in humility today, brethren. They don't know how to solve our problems. And if they can't, their own problems, if they can't solve their own problems, how can they solve the problems of this world? Here's what the Weekly Standard wrote in March 13, 2006 about the Harvard affair. So then early last summer, Summers dropped the bomb that would lead directly to his ouster, speaking at a research conference on the subject, diversifying the science and engineering workforce. He suggested, citing research literature, that the paucity of female professors in fields like physics, astronomy, and mathematics was due less to discrimination and more to career choices. Now, if you think about that, it's not really a bad statement. There is a difference between men and women. Not just physically. I think you've noticed that. That we are different for a very great purpose, thank God. But anyhow, differences is in the aptitude between the sexes. He called for more research on the subject. Just research. That's all he asked for. Though the critics on the faculty outraged by the suggestion that there might be deep differences between men and women. Now, really, do you think there are deep differences between men and women? Well, there better be. Or why not just have all men or all women? I mean, God could find another way to procreate mankind if He wanted to. But is there a difference, brethren? Of course there's a difference. Of course there's a difference. God created a difference. And we all, I think, know that. But he said that there might be deep differences between men and women, but you've got some women there that really hated this and wouldn't tolerate it. He insisted that it was wrong for the president to call for research on a subject about which they had made up their minds. Now, that's true, I believe. Well, who are you to be going out and researching a subject that we've already decided is that you're wrong in? Now, what kind of education is that? Let's get serious about education. What kind is it? Well, you can't even research in Harvard on certain subjects. even though they admit, many people admit, that this needs to be researched and needs to be understood a lot better. Well, of course, they don't understand the Bible, and that's where they have the big problem. But I'll just quickly read this to you. Summers' assessment was obviously true, but it was also one that left-wing faculty members, particularly feminists, did not wish to hear. I mean, they're like this unisex type thinking in a lot of cases. They, in other words, they're just like men. And men are just like women, which is ridiculous. The fallout from these remarks is vivid evidence that of all the victim groups on campus, the feminists wield by far the greatest influence. It is unfortunate that in response to heated criticisms, Summers chose to apologize for his remarks instead of defending them on intellectual grounds. He just caved in and said, "Well, all right, I'm sorry. I shouldn't ask for research on that subject." Even though, well, what is education if you can't even research for the truth? I mean, that's a kind of a tyranny. That's what it really amounts to. The episode was a boon for the feminist group, so much so that one suspects they worked overtime to keep the controversy alive in order to extract maximum concessions from their mortally wounded president. Soon, Summers appointed historian Drew Faust to head an initiative to improve the status of women in the university. She remarked at the time that Summers' talk had created a moment of enormous possibility for women on the campus. And so they took the opportunity and kicked him out, even though two-thirds of the students wanted him to stay. And most of the faculty and the whole university wanted him to stay. That wasn't even democratic, really. The apologies and concessions did Summers little good, for the advocates of diversity on campus will tolerate nothing less than wholehearted endorsement of their aims. Now that really is the way it is in education today. Jesus Christ said, their minds they have closed. They just closed their minds. No research. No, no, no. Not even research. In our number one university. And here we are facing human survival. Human survival. And all they can do is fight and bicker over who's going to get charged at Harvard. I wonder if you realize, brethren, how bad it is in this world. I wonder if we realize how truly, truly terrible it is. I'll just read you one more comment. These are from people in the world. This is from a lady. Well, really, that's the same thing. I don't think I need to read that to you. If I have time, I might read it later. But it's basically saying the same thing. I just wanted to read it to you from a woman. But I don't think you women have trouble with that. And she was talking about these Harvard man-eaters. People, women, that just frankly hate men and want to rule Harvard. Now, everybody wants to rule. But how do you prepare to rule? Everybody wants to be in charge. Everybody thinks, well, now, if I could be in charge, I'd get things straightened out. And that's a problem with man. Well, he can't straighten out the problems. He can't straighten them out at all. I've always felt, brethren, that one of the greatest gifts God ever gave me was the gift of going to Ambassador College. And the one reason I thought about it as being a gift is because I knew when I was there, and clearly knew that I wouldn't have been there if it hadn't been for people like yourselves. Many of you perhaps even were there, making it possible for students to go to college. And if God hadn't worked through you and had done it that way, we couldn't have gone. It's subsidized up to beyond what most people would even imagine. And I was very happy to see our student body president in his address talk about how thankful he was to you, to the people, for supporting the college. And we didn't prompt him to say that. We didn't prod him. We didn't do anything like that.
He just said it. We want to thank you for making this all possible. And that's true. That's true. None of us would have been able to go to college if it hadn't been for God's people, the teacher's college, who made it all possible. I lived in St. Louis, Missouri when I first came into church. And like a lot of young people, I wanted to very much to go to Ambassador College. And so I'll just give you a few examples. And I still remember when I was a young man, well, let's say younger than what I am now. So. I wanted to go to college, and I talked to Dr. Hay about that. And I think I was about 25 or 26. And that Dr. Hay talked to me for a while, and then he asked me, well, why haven't you done more with your life? And I mean, that was a hard question, but one of the best ones I was ever asked in my life. Well, why haven't you done more in your life? And I had to really think about that. And I was corrected by it and decided that I had to make some changes, because I was really wasting my life, just like you heard in the sermonette, to a great extent. Where was I going? I knew something needed to be done in my life, but I didn't quite know what to do. But anyhow, I started going to night school and ended up getting like 36 hours at Washington's University in St. Louis. And began, as Dr. Hay said, well, you need to get involved in the local area and do everything you can in the church. And so I thought, well, I've got to get as involved in this church as I possibly can. And I think about two or three years later, I was a deacon in the church, and I was serving in the church. But I can remember when I was sitting in those depositions and Dr. Hay was being deposed, and we had our lawyers ask him, say, well, do you think that the college today has become like it was in the 70s and like Mr. Armstrong prophesied that it would? And he said, well, absolutely not. And I thought to myself, well, now I could ask Dr. Hay a question that he asked me, sort of like that. Well, what have you done, Dr. Hay, since Mr. Armstrong died? Here we are with the Spirit of God. What have we done, you see, or what? We always need to be asking ourselves that question. What have we done with our lives? And we all, I think, could see areas where we could do more. But God is not concerned as much about the past as He is right now with the Spirit of God. With the Spirit of God. So I applied to college after I talked to Dr. Hay and thought I'd maybe gotten far enough along that I'd get accepted, but I was rejected as a single person. Then later on I got married and got accepted as a marriage student. And I got accepted, I've mentioned some of these things before, I think, to you, but some time ago, I got accepted on Friday, and then the orientation was going to be the following Wednesday. And here, that doesn't give you much time to get out of town. So I had made arrangements just in case I got accepted to where I could get out pretty quickly, but I got that notice, and then I said, well, now, how am I going to get out of here and get to Pasadena? I'd even sold my car and was sort of had an arrangement. But I looked in the paper that morning, and here was this guy that wanted somebody to drive a Lincoln Continental to Los Angeles, California. I thought, well, now that's really, really nice. You sometimes, when God starts working these things in your life, and we've seen that, many, I think all of us have seen that happen, where you know God is working it out. I mean, it didn't have much time. Something had to happen very quickly. So Barbara and I got the kid. We just had one kid at the time. Laura was 6 months old. Put our clothes in the back seat, threw Laura in on top of the clothes. And at that time, Stephen was nowhere to be found. So we took off to Pasadena, and I was just thrilled. And I've never had a more exciting experience in my life, I think, than Ambassador, Ambassador College, and now, of course, Armstrong College, which is a different matter. But sometimes you have had experiences like that where God has done those things, and you know, brethren, you know that was a miracle. And you don't want to forget those miracles, because God does that consistently for His people. There are times when we just have to have a miracle. And we get it. We get it every single time that we really need it and have to have it. And I can still remember when I was going to Pasadena that I was nervous going into Pasadena. I think some of those fears were, well, wrongly based perhaps, but I was almost in awe, and perhaps was in awe in some ways, of Ambassador College and what was being done there, and thought, wow, what am I doing going there? What am I doing here at Ambassador College? And I knew that I was going to a college that wasn't accredited. I mean, Harvard would scoff at that college, not even accredited. Can you imagine that? But of course, we know, we all know, that it was accredited by God. But you couldn't tell those scholarly people that. They wouldn't listen to somebody who didn't have credentials from Harvard or Oxford or Yale or some other college that doesn't know what true education is. And it's pretty bad when they're responsible mainly for the education and we're about to erase all human life. I'd say something is terribly wrong with education. And I think we all see that very clearly. So I wanted to go and learn about true education. And we're learning that whether we go to college or not. You know that. When we got there, I was just like about anybody else, and I remember into the first year, the professor said, well, look, if you come and you need help and you get correction, your stock goes up. It goes up. So I took him up on that, and Barbara and I were having trouble making some adjustments to college, and she was trying to take some classes, and we decided, well, she needed to just audit, because it was getting too hard. We had to take care of Laura, and then Stephen had still not been born at that time. He was born there in Pasadena. But so we decided that she would audit classes, and there were a few problems we felt like we needed to talk about. And I think, to really be honest with you, I think they looked at that and said, oh boy, what are we doing? What do we bring this guy here for? Anyhow, I heard from some pretty reliable rumors that they were going to send me home after the first year. And I suppose it was probably because they realized I was a person with problems, just like, well, maybe more than they would have liked to have dealt with, I don't know. But anyhow, I had problems. But there's one thing that I really began to learn, brethren, and I think we all need to learn this very deeply, that it really wasn't their college. That was God's college. And I took God at His word, or the faculty member's word, and I did, got correction like He said I should. And I've always seen, and every time in a situation like that, if you just go to your head, Jesus Christ, then it'll always turn out right. See, that's why I have mentioned to you in the past, Satan hates that. And in both of those depositions I took, the first question they asked me, as I mentioned before, is, who is the head of the PCG? And I always answer, Jesus Christ. They don't like that. They don't like that. You mean to tell me, of all these ministers around the world, you're the only one that is a prophet of God? I said, well, that's my understanding. Now, they don't like that, and Harvard's not going to like the fact that we tell them they don't know what true education is. They don't know. They have a responsibility for human annihilation. They're accountable. And who are they to stand up like they're these great authorities, and the ultimate success they have reached is the fact that we're about to destroy all human life. It's going to happen, brethren, if Christ doesn't stop it. Many experts see that now. I mean, I don't care. You see, who doesn't admit that or who doesn't understand it is still true. I mean, we're facing the worst times of suffering men have ever known. If our young people or adults or anybody else leave this church and decide they want to go to Harvard or they want to do it the world's way, they're going to find out what I'm saying is true. What am I going to have to tell these people at those campaigns when I have them? What am I going to have to tell them, brethren? Am I going to have to say to them, well, I don't know what else to tell them, except that, look, most of you are not going to listen to my words, but shortly, every single one of you will know that this was a message from God. It's just a matter of when they decide to accept it. That's what it is. A message from God. And you see, brethren, we all make our mistakes. I made my mistakes. Probably wasn't any different than what most of you would have been if you'd gone to college. I made mistakes. But I always kept reminding myself, this is God's college. And God will straighten it out if I submit to Him. He'll take care of those problems. And He always has. He always has. When I was a junior in college, they sent me out into the field to visit, well, right there in Pasadena, actually, but to visit with brethren just like you, go around and help in any way we could. And of course, I was just learning how to do it. And I ran into somewhat of another problem. This guy, and I mean, ministers are flawed. I really think this guy probably shouldn't have been in the ministry, or at least he should have been more closely supervised. Perhaps that's a better way to put it. But he was making a lot of mistakes, and I didn't know how to handle that. And of course, I had my vanity and all my problems, but he was my boss, but I knew things were not right. Even then, I knew that he wasn't doing his job the way he should. So I let it go for the summer, and then at the end of the summer, I just went and told his boss what I thought, and they'd already told me that I was going out in the field to work in the ministry. And of course, that was thrilling to me because that was my number one desire. But anyhow, I thought, well, I guess that's taking care of that, and that's all I knew to do, and that's what I did. But when they started, in those days, they'd read out the names of where you were going, usually, and if you were going in the field or something like that. I had a job at headquarters, and they're all important jobs. No, one's probably just about as important as any other, but when they read off the names, my name wasn't on there, and I was, as you would have been, I'm sure, confused and upset, saying, well, what happened? What happened? So I knew that, I guess I have to mention a couple names here, but I knew that Mr. Meredith had to be the one that stopped that. So I kept calling him and calling him, and finally, I think he was just bothered by me continually calling, and he said he'd see me. Because I wanted to know what happened. Why did they change their minds? Nobody told me, and I really felt like they ought to have at least told me. They didn't tell me, so I kept calling, and finally I got to go in his office and went into his office, and Mr. Luker was there, and then They told him that I was there. And Mr. Meredith came in, I guess for about 2 or 3 minutes, corrected me pretty hard, and then off he went. Didn't even really stay, and he left that to Mr. Luker. So Mr. Luker pointed out the problems, and I've mentioned this before, because I have always, brethren, always accepted that, as I knew that maybe everything they did wasn't exactly right, but I knew absolutely God's hand was in that and that He was correcting me. I knew that. I just didn't know what I was doing that was wrong. Now, I won't get into all those problems, but I met Mr. Luker the next day and said, "Look, I see where I need to change, and I'm going to make those changes." And he said, "Well, I hope so." And I really meant that. I was going to change, because that's what I went there to do, to change. But there is always a certain amount of correction involved in changing. I'm sure we all have learned that. So, there was no attitude of defending myself, though I really thought it probably would have been better if they'd gotten me and this minister together and just had us talk it out. But I'm not sure about that. Anyhow, this, I might just mention this. I got a letter from this minister I visited with this past week, and he was just talking about it. He takes the trumpet, and he was talking about what a great article that was on leadership, which was an article actually I've already read and helped a little bit on getting that the way we wanted it. Brad McDonald wrote it, but it is a great article, and he was really moved by that article on leadership. So, but here's the thing, brethren, we are human and we make mistakes. But I think we make less mistakes like that today because we are smaller. And unlike Mr. Armstrong, I've always worked directly with the ministers, and Mr. Armstrong simply couldn't do that. It was just too big. And in those last few years, he just couldn't handle all of that at all. But anyhow, after that correction, before they read off the names, this managing editor had come to me and asked me if I wanted to work in editorial. And I said, "Well, no, I'm not interested in that. I want to go out in the field." He already knew I wasn't going out in the field. And so they were being merciful to me. So after I decided I didn't have a job, I went back to him and said that I'd really be happy to try it in editorial. And we were entering at that time. This was 1971. We were getting into those infamous 70s. So it was getting to be a pretty bad time in the church. And when I talked to the guy about it, though, I told him why I didn't. I'd rather go out in the field. And he didn't like some of the things I said. And I was getting quite a lot of correction there in the last days of my... I thought it was the last days of my career at Ambassador College anyhow. And he told Mr. Hill what I said. And I think, didn't have the respect for the editorial department that I should have had. And I do think there was some vanity in my life there. So then Mr. Hill, he called me up. And he corrected me pretty severely about that. And I said... I told him, I said, "Well, I can see what you mean, and I certainly will change that." So I was getting, had a pretty good track record of correction. Now, I know that we all get correction, but again, brethren, I think you know that God is going to see to it that we all do get correction. Because how else are you going to change? How else are you going to get Harvard to go from Harvard to Armstrong College without a lot of change? And it'd be nice if they listened to words. And I love those people. And Christ loved those people and died for them. But how are you going to get them to listen? Well, they're going to listen after all this has come to pass. Read Ezekiel 33 and verse 33. When all these things come to pass, then shall they know that a prophet has been in their midst. You mean somebody representing God? Then they're going to know. It's too bad that they don't listen now. But anyhow, I had a great career, as long as it lasted, in the editorial department. It lasted about a year. And then I got fired. So, but anyhow, you can look back, and if you want to really research this, and prove, I can prove to you that I did work there, because I've got a couple of articles back in 1971, 71, maybe 72, and I just as proof to you that I really was in the editorial department. But it was getting awfully liberal then, and I began to learn some lessons even then, and I knew that something was wrong, and I knew the men over me were liberal. And I knew they didn't like what I believed. And yet I knew that I was pretty close to what Mr. Armstrong believed. So after a year, they said, well, look, we just can't use you. You're not fitting in here. And so they fired me. Well, by that time, my wife and I we kind of had all of Ambassador College we wanted, I think. And we're happy to go out in the field, out in the world and get a job. And so I got another call from Mr. Hill. I said, oh boy, what's this? And Mr. Hill called me up and he said, how would you like to go out in the ministry? And I said, well, I'd love to. I said, that's what I've always wanted most to do. So he said, well, look, I've got a job for you. You can go down to Norwalk, which is about 30 miles south of Pasadena, and you can work there for a minister. And so I really continued my Ambassador College education in a way, because I continued to take one class every year, as well as being in an area where some Sabbaths we'd have two evangelists come down there. We had a morning and afternoon service, and some Sabbaths I'd hear two evangelists speak. And that went on for three and a half years. And I felt like, being able to take that class as well, that I was probably given about the best education from Ambassador College you could ever get. And I've really been thankful to God for that. And what a blessing it is to just be a part of whatever God is doing. When we were in that area, one of our halls burned down, and we were switching around trying to find a different place to meet. And I was scheduled, I'd get to give a few sermons, not very many, but a few. And I was scheduled to speak on this one Sabbath after the hall had burned down. And of all things, I think for two Sabbaths, we got to go to Pasadena in God's house. And here I was scheduled to give a sermon in God's own house, the only one I ever gave there. And I wasn't even a minister. And I got to speak in God's house. And you probably can imagine what I spoke on. Yeah, I think this might have been inspired. But anyhow, I spoke on government, of all things. Government. I worked hard on that. And after I gave that message, of course, they had phone hookups in those days. And a lot of people would be listening in that you didn't know were listening in. And so we had this one, he was pastor rank minister at that time, listening in, and he wrote me a note and said that he thought that was just a wonderful sermon and one of the best sermons he'd heard on government. And all I did really was just went through notes that I'd heard in the past from Mr. Armstrong and others and talked about that. Later on, that man rebelled against that same government. But I thought it was kind of ironic that here I was in the early 70s when things were obviously getting off track, as you've heard Mr. Armstrong say so many times, getting off track. And here I was, a non-minister, talking to those people who were listening in. I don't know how many listened in, probably not very many. But anyhow, I gave a sermon in God's house on government. Government. Now that was the problem all these men were dealing with. That's the problem they were all having in the 70s. They wouldn't listen to what Mr. Armstrong told them to do. I mean, to a man, they were having problems with government. And the church was entering into the worst decade ever under Mr. Armstrong. And really, brethren, I think certainly part of the reason I'm in here today doing work for God is that attitude toward God's government. I hope that's a big part of the reason. But I would like for you to ask yourself, I'll have a question for you like the sermonette speaker, and that is, do you really love God's government? Do you really love it? Because it's the only thing. I mean, if you don't love it, you're not going to make it. Do you really love God's government? I mean, love it. Hunger and thirst after righteousness, which means hunger and thirst after God's rule, His righteousness. So He'll rule you and make you righteous the way He is. Do you hunger and thirst for government? Now that pastor ranked minister knew that what I was saying was right, but he could never quite come to grips with doing anything about it. So anyhow, I went down and worked for this man, and he was just perfect for me. But it wasn't easy. He was a profound thinker, very good at counseling people. And I looked at him, and I was in awe, practically, of the way he did it. He was so good at it. And literally, I've heard him sometimes take, let's say, those two sermons we might have gotten from two evangelists, because evangelists came down quite often. And I've heard those sermons, and I've heard him then talk to people that maybe weren't there on that Sabbath and tell them what was given, what sermons were given. And he would sit there and feed those messages back to those people, and I got more out of the sermon from what he said than I did from those people originally. In a lot of cases, he was so clear. His mind was so absolutely clear, could he ever think? And that wasn't exactly my strong point, I suppose. At that time, I really needed to learn how to think more. But he and I were very different in a lot of ways. He was a person that was very much, let's say, into his own thoughts a lot, and much more reserved than I was. I can remember sometimes walking into his office like on Monday morning, and he wouldn't even speak. And to me, that was a little odd. But, I mean, again, it was fine. He had a great attitude at that time, as far as I know. But we had that and other reasons. It was just hard for me. We were so different. It was hard for me to fit in. And I thought, well, now, I began to wonder about my calling, or whether or not I belonged in the ministry. And so there was a minister that I began with in the church, and I loved him very much, and he loved me, I think, and he was very much like my father in many ways. And so he happened to be there in that area at that time, and I called him and said, hey, I'd like to talk to you about a few things. So I went down and counseled with him, and said, I just somehow begun to wonder if maybe I don't really fit in the ministry. And of course, he, in essence, said, well, we don't fit in anything spiritually. You know, we don't fit unless we do something to make ourselves fit. But he said, look, God didn't call us to quit. He didn't call us to quit. And I knew he was right. And probably, if I think, when I think back about that, brethren, I think, well, what would have happened to me in my life if I had not counseled? If you think counseling with the ministry isn't important, we all go through trials and difficulties. And I've had trials and difficulties just like you have had, and wondered about, well, should I even be in the ministry? I still wasn't ordained at that time. I think you can probably understand why. But I just honestly wondered if God was calling me into the ministry. Now, I have many books. Some people have talked about a lot of books I have, but I, to be honest with you, I've only gotten into probably 30 or 50 of those booklets really heavily, because they're great books. And this minister that was over me then, at that time, anyhow, I went back and straightened out my attitude. It was just my negative attitude. But anyhow, he taught me that it's more important to think than it is to read. Because when you read, well, you're getting other men's thoughts. What are your thoughts? What do you think? Let's not parrot what some professor from Harvard says when he doesn't know what he's talking about. We need to learn to think, and now, of course, we have God's Holy Spirit, and we can think like Christ. Think like Christ, brethren. That's what we're here to do. Now, this man even took the trumpet. He and his wife took the trumpet early on after there was a break in the church, I think he wasn't thinking too much then, but his wife said, take her off the list, and he said the same thing. So I can tell you that things haven't gone well for them at all. Serious problems that I'll not even get into, because they are that serious. But I told him after 3.5 years, I said, look, what I have learned here from you is equal to what I learned at Ambassador College. Because he really taught me something. It wasn't easy learning all that, but I just sat there. I mean, I spent more time with that man than I did with my wife. Like 6 days a week, visit. Most of the time with him, watching him do the job. And then sometimes, of course, he'd turn it over to me and let me do it and see how I did. But I watched him do it, and it was just the most magnificent education I think I could ever have gotten. Now, God just step by step educated me like he's doing you. Step by step, he's educating every single one of us. You read that in 1 Corinthians 12. That's the way it is in the body. He's preparing everyone. Because each person has a different role and a different responsibility. God is preparing you to rule the world. Harvard and Yale, but we'll probably change all those names to Ambassador College or Armstrong College or whatever. That's what we're here for, brethren. That's what you are here for. And I mean, it isn't going to be long till we are ruling this world. And we have to get ready. And it takes correction to do that. Now, I'm not talking about becoming a correction addict. I don't think you have to worry about that, because we tend to dislike it so much. But it isn't natural and it isn't easy to be corrected. God says it's grievous. Now, I went through some grievous times, and I felt like the biggest failure in the world, because I wasn't making it at all. And I know you have felt that way at times yourself. But the big lesson is to get ourselves out of the way, brethren. And I can tell you by experience that God will bless you beyond your wildest dreams. I can tell you that by experience I've had for quite a long time in God's church, over 40 years now. Let's look at Hebrews 12 and verse 1. Do you think you've suffered terribly? Well, here's an example of one who suffered a lot more. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us. Lay it aside, overcome it, conquer it, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, or the trials and tests, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. That's where we're going to be sitting shortly. And Paul says, verse 3, for consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest you be wearied and faint in your minds. In other words, here Jesus Christ came to this earth. He created all of us. He created us. And where he was marred more than any man ever was. And he did it so that you and I could become sons of God. That's why he did it. Paul said, now you need to consider that. Think about that, what he did and why he did it. Think about that. Or if you don't, you're going to faint in your minds. Better think about that long and hard, brethren. And don't lose sight of why he did all this. It's about family. It's about being born in the family of God. Now don't you forget why this is all happening, or you're going to faint. You're going to get discouraged because you're not going to see beyond the trial, beyond the correction. Notice verse 4. You have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin, and you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks unto you as unto children, my son, despise not you the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when you are rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives. Verse 7. If you endure chastening, God deals with you as with sons. For what son is he? Is he whom the Father chastens not? You parents, you fathers, you mothers, do you have a son that you don't chasten? And when you chasten them, is that because you hate them? Oh, no, just the reverse. It's because you love them if you're doing it God's way. That's why you do it. It's because you love them. You want them to turn out to have character and to be like you, your parents in many ways, and certainly like God. That's why you do it. It says, look, do you understand that I'm dealing with you as a son? My son. That's why I'm doing this. You're a son of God. Did you know that's one of the major signs that you're a son of God if you're being corrected? I mean, really, when I went through college after I got through in the ministry and all that, and of course the correction didn't end there at all, but I knew I'd been corrected. But without that, where in the world would I go? What could I possibly do without God, letting God treat me like His Son? He's not going to let those guys at Harvard rule this world and lead them to human annihilation again? Why would He go through such an exercise in folly? You show me a person who knows he's the Son of God and will let God correct him, and I will show you a person that's going to rule the world And I mean rule it. If you're the president, you'll be the president. And the faculty won't kick you out. Because God will see to that. That's where it's all leading, brethren, so very soon. That's where all of this is taking us. Verse 8. But if you be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are you bastards and not sons. Pretty nasty word, spiritually. That's what you are if you won't take correction. Verse 9, furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? The Father of spirits took me through all those experiences at Ambassador College and those since, and then when I went out in the ministry, I learned to apply that. And you know the paradox of all this, brethren, is those men that taught me and inspired me, and I actually was in a certain awe of some of them. I've had to learn to get straightened out some of my thinking there. But I have seen their lives unravel to a man because they wouldn't let God correct them the way Mr. Armstrong said they ought to be corrected. They wouldn't let what Mr. Armstrong said correct them. The apostle of God, the man in this end time that God has sent to restore all things, and somehow they were just a little too scholarly and a little too mighty to be corrected by, well, that old man. But it wasn't that old man at all. It was God. It was God. Of course, they had to get rid of his Elijah office, because then that makes it God who's doing that correction. And I've seen those people, brethren. I could go into examples today, and I won't do it because you'd know some of the people I'm talking about. But I mean to tell you, they've suffered even this far in decisions that they have made. One evangelist and his wife that I know of, I think both of them died as alcoholics. That's an ignominious, painful end of men who were my heroes. And I'll tell you, they corrected me. And some of those that, I mean, directly corrected me, brethren, I've seen their end, and it makes me cry. It wasn't that way when they were talking to me. I'll tell you, they were being used by God. But somehow, you see, after a while, they couldn't handle the pressure and the stress of Ambassador College because they ceased to be corrected and their father wasn't giving them the power and the strength that they needed. Now, we've had all those examples by the hundreds and thousands out there for us to see. And here we are, this little remnant that I'll talk to you about later, and when I talk to the conference, we'll send some of those tapes out, I'm sure. A little remnant, you're going to see how that happens to be us in a very specific way. But there's a little remnant that will... And will listen to God and know that they're sons. And they know that God is correcting them. Not a man. 99% of the correction you get is probably from God. Now, we're not perfect. But brethren, we do have to be corrected. Christ said through Paul, and the Father said through Paul, look, do you realize that I'm dealing with you as my son? And he says also in Paul, he said, Hebrews 1 and 2, he said, to which of the angels did God ever say, this day have I begotten you, and you are my son? He never said it to them. These brilliant, fiery magnificent angels, never had God say, "You are my son." What is that worth, brethren, to be here and know you're God's son? Now that's real, that's reality, and I mean to tell you, God is going to reward us according to that. We are sons. And you won't find a better blessing than that, no matter how long you look. And if you think I took pleasure in those men and what's happened to them, people who think that don't know my mind. And I don't think they know your mind either, because that is the way we thought about them. I tell you, brethren, those men were truly my greatest heroes I've ever had. And to see that happen, well, it breaks your heart. Let's go on down to verse 10. For they verily for a few days chasten us after their own pleasure, that is our physical fathers. But he for our profit, always, this is 100% right when God is correcting you. It's going to profit you. It's going to profit you that you might be partakers of his holiness. That's what this is all about. That's what the correction is all about. God is making you holy. Holy, brethren. Holy as he is. A son of God. Verse 11. Now, no chastening for the present seems to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yields a peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. It's grievous, but God says, now, it's not just if you get this, it's not if you hear it, but you're going to have to be exercised by it. In other words, it's going to have to change you. Change you. Is there anything bad about that? Is there anything bad about changing rotten, evil human nature? Oh, brethren, we have to change it. We have to be exercised by our Father and the Spirit. We're God's sons. And God, the Father, is correcting us. And that's the most wonderful blessing we could have. And when he stops correcting you, you become, in biblical language, a bastard. No father. No parentage. No parentage at all. Verse 12. Wherefore lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees. Now, see, I have to tell you, when I got to the end of college, my hands were sort of hanging down, I think. And I had some feeble knees. But it didn't last long because I saw the value of that correction. Verse 13, and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. Brethren, there are parts of our character or parts of our constitution spiritually that need to be changed. We need to be healed. We need to be healed, God says. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing, to be healed. And let God heal you. And get rid of those, take it, good correction, and you'll get rid of those feeble knees very quickly. But I want you to know, brethren, in verse 12 and 13, that the negative attitude is associated with rejecting correction. Now that's what makes us negative. And I think once in a while you'll see a person that really struggles, it seems like, almost all their lives. Because they can't quite get accept the correction God is giving. And we must be able to do that, brethren. Now, I don't think that's true of most of our people, but I'm sure it's true of all of us at one time or the other. But he says you are to become as little children. You think those people at Harvard, in Oxford, I just heard one, he's retiring from Oxford this week, I believe. You know what he said? He's in the seminary part of the college. And he said, if you take the Bible and you read it, you see that God approves of homosexual relationships. All you have to do is it's right there in the Bible. Of course, he didn't prove it. He didn't give any scriptures. But do you think, brethren, that demented mind is ever going to teach for God? Right there at Oxford, well, certainly, if not they may be number one, too, ranked by many people, certainly number two. Probably number two because, well, Harvard is so wealthy. But here is this man who teaches religion there telling you that that's what the Bible says. Is that what the Bible says? No, 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 it isn't. Not even close. Not even close. And he ought to know that. And we're going to tell him. They're not going to like it. They're not going to like it at all. I mean, really, brethren, when you think this, you've seen this Da Vinci, oh, excuse me, I hope you haven't seen it. You've heard about it. You've heard about this Da Vinci Code. I've seen the ads and I know what it's about and I've read a little about it. But it really, some of the religions that are upset about it, I think, for the wrong reasons. Because it somehow batters their religion around. But what really is upsetting about that, brethren, is what it says about this Word of God. And it is, well, let's say, to use the word loosely, I guess, it is blasphemous. Christ was married and married Mary Magdalene and they had children and blah, 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 blah. And it's going to cause, I'm sure, millions of people around the world. It's a blockbuster. Millions of people are going to have less belief in this, probably because of that wretched, diabolical movie. I'm saying that because of what it says about the Bible. But brethren, we have a lot to teach this world. A lot to teach them if we will let God correct us now. But we must learn to be different than what they are. You know, I mean, you can talk to that guy from Oxford and you can show him in a heartbeat all these scriptures that make him into a liar. Can't you? Of course you can. You see, they just say, well, the Bible is what I want it to say. That's what it says. It says what I want it to say. Well, they are just people that don't know anything about God, though they think they do. Verse 14, follow peace with all men, peace, brethren, and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. This correction brings peace. Looking diligently, lest any man fall of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. That's what happens if you don't accept correction. This is what happens, brother. We get bitter. And that is just like peeking right into the lake of fire. If you stay with that. Now, we all have to fight our bad attitudes. I fought my negative attitudes in college and still fight them today because I'm carnal, just like you. I have carnality that I still have to battle just like you. It is a struggle, it's a battle. But what a wonderful victory it is to conquer these lame characteristics that we have. What peace that brings into our life. Peace, brethren. It really does. It truly does bring peace in, as Paul said. Peace into our lives. Well, if you go the other way, you know what's going to come into your life. Verse 16, lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. Birthright. You have a birthright. You have a right to be born, brethren. A right to be born. Born into what? Born into the family of God. A birthright. How much would you sell it for? Is there anything you'd take for your birthright? What would it take? Is there any price that people could pay you and you'd say, okay, I'll give up my birthright? My right to be born as God. What a birthright. What a birthright. Do you think they teach that at Harvard? No, they don't, brethren. To their own ignorance, they don't teach it. They don't teach it. And they won't be teaching it. We'll be teaching it to them. Verse 25. I have to move along here. Verse 25. See that you refuse not him that speaks. See that you refuse not him that speaks for God, it could say, for if they escape not who refused him that spoke on earth, much more shall not we escape if we turn away from him that speaks from heaven. What's going to happen, brethren, if we turn away from God who speaks from heaven? What are we going to do then? Well, there's no place else to go. As Peter said, verse 28, wherefore we receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us have grace whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. For our God is a consuming fire. But he does say in verse 27 that he's going to shake things. He's going to shake things loose that shouldn't be here. He'll do that, brethren. God will do that. I remember one year at college, and as I said, I really appreciated Ambassador College, and of course the Feast of Tabernacles was the highlight of the year. And I remember one year they told me I was working one half of the time during the Feast of Tabernacles. And that just seemed horrible to me. I thought, well, surely God wouldn't want us to work half the time during the Feast of Tabernacles. So I worked trying to get out of that, and I couldn't do it. And I got exposed for some more of my selfishness. And saw, finally, that God, well, he corrected me for that. And saw that he wanted me to be corrected. And I, for one half of that feast, I just worked at headquarters to help them get the word done, because people kept calling in. We did that during the weekdays, or the days that were not holy days. And I can truly say that was one of the happiest feasts of my life. And you see, it's all a matter of our attitude. See, God is going to bless us at the Feast of Tabernacles even if we work half the time. But we're so selfish. It's hard to get the self out of the way. But we have to work and do that. And the more we do it, the more God gives us his peace and his joy and his happiness. But oh, how hard that is to learn sometimes. Just get self out of the way. And then you begin to see that you don't have feeble knees. Haven't we all had feeble knees? Well, now let's see. I'm not walking too steadily here, spiritually. I think we've all experienced that. I can remember even in one of the college speech classes that we used to get, they just opened it up and let everybody criticize the speaker if they wanted to, good and bad. But I mean to tell you, when you came out of there, sometimes you knew you'd been corrected. Some of those students kind of liked working you over. But the correction was good. It was a wonderful experience. It was good, every bit of it. I don't regret it at all. But you look at, maybe we have time to turn there. 1 Peter 2 and verse 20. And I'll read verse 21 as well, because it applies to this. 1 Peter 2 and verse 20. For what glory is it if when you be buffeted for your faults, you shall take it patiently? But if when you do well and suffer for it, you take it patiently, this is acceptable with God. In other words, here, brethren, you're doing well. And Christ said, now look, there are times when you're going to get corrected for doing well, doing a good thing. And he says, that's good. That's good. It's okay to get buffeted around. You remember Jesus Christ? What he had, he was good. Well, he said he wasn't good. I better be careful how I say that. But I'll tell you this, he never sinned. And we know that he was righteous always, and yet he was buffeted like nobody ever has been. Verse 21, for even hereunto were you called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps. See, we're going to get corrected. We're going to get corrected. And that's okay. Christ came to this earth to suffer, and he says, now I want you to follow his example. I want you to be willing to take correction and suffer and change whenever you need to. And we've all had some pretty bad backgrounds. I don't think I've mentioned this to the church that I can remember, unless it was in the early days, but I'll mention it to you, not because I want to. I'd frankly rather not mention some of my past, but I'll mention it because I think there's a lesson in it. And about the time that I was called, some things were, we were, if you have trouble maybe sometimes with an authority figure. Well, when I was growing up, my dad didn't whip me a lot. Or spank me a lot. You wouldn't call those spankings that he gave. But boy, when he did, he really did crack down in a very hard and trying way. Usually with a switch or something like that, pretty good sized one. And so my dad was pretty violent in some ways. But about the time that I was being called, one stormy night, he was out back. And he was knocking to get in, and nobody heard him. My mom didn't, and I didn't, and nobody heard him. But finally, I heard him, and he was just drenched back at the back door, and he was just in a rage, and saying that we just wouldn't let him in, and of course we couldn't hear him because it was lightning and thundering, and he was drunk. And so he came in and came in the house and went back in the back bedroom, and he came out and he had a handgun, and well, he was coming after me. And so I saw what he was doing, and I reached to grab the gun, but before I did, he had it against my head, and I heard the gun click, and I thought, well, it must not be loaded. So I took it away from him after that. And I thought, well, this is, it's obviously not loaded, but I have to be careful. And I was so sure it wasn't loaded that I stuck the gun in my sister's closet wardrobe and fired the gun, and bam, went off and shot a hole through all of her dresses just about. It was almost worse than me if I'd have been shot. If you understand how women feel about their wardrobes. But humanly, I'd rather not mention that. But the point is, of course, I was being called, and it's another one of those miracles of God. I verily do believe God saved my life, and that's not the only time. I think there are two or three other times He saved my life. But the reason I mentioned that, and the reason that I mentioned it to the students, was simply this. That sometimes we'll hold back because, well, we had a bad background or we had problems in our past, and you just can't quite get over it, and you can't quite stop thinking about it, and, well, maybe think, well, if I hadn't had this happen to me in the past or that happened to me, well, maybe I could make it. But look, I'll tell you, with my dad's authority, and he abused it, it's been a struggle in some ways for me to get my mind straight about authority in the church. Because I have seen authority abused, and I think I've learned to hate that about as much as anything. But did you know, brethren, that most of us came into this church as somewhat of a social wreck? I mean, isn't that the truth? We're the lowly of the world. We've had come out of drunken families. Now, my mom was just about the reverse of my dad, and she kept me from going crazy. But she certainly wasn't perfect. But we've all, I think many of us, have had some pretty bad backgrounds. And I like to mention this once in a while to my children because they didn't have families like that. And we were able, brethren, because of God, to stop the madness of this world. I mean, some of the things we've gone through as children are absolutely something we don't even want to talk about because it's so horrible. And you and I have the opportunity to stop that. My children have never experienced that in their lives, though they've certainly experienced a lot with their flawed father. But it's getting better, you see. It kept getting better all the time, as it does in the church. But we've all come out of a world that has really left us deeply scarred. But what are we going to do? Just sit around and mope about it and say, well, what could I do? What could I do? What can you do, brethren? Let's say if you've come out of some situation like that or a lot worse, you've come out of that. What can you do? Well, as Mr. Armstrong told that student when we went over to his house the night we had the seniors over, he said, why, the student said, why, this meal is fit for a king. Mr. Armstrong said, well, you are a king. You are a king. Do you know that's what exactly what you are? A king and a priest. I'm not going to go around feeling sorry for you. And you shouldn't go around feeling sorry for yourself. That's what you are. Brethren, that's what you are. And soon we'll be given those titles before the whole world. I don't care how far back you were in this scale of this world. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 26, and I'll quickly conclude this. Verse 26. For you see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. Do we ever confound them? I mean, we're just confounding them all the time. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. And base things of the world, and things which are despised, has God chosen, yea, and things which are not, to bring to naught things which are, that no flesh should glory in His presence. See, if we start glorying about how great we are, well, we're going to get out there and get ourselves killed spiritually by our overconfidence. But we're going to be kings and priests, even though we came out of the lowly levels of society. I mean, that's what it means, that we had social problems, we had emotional problems, we had mental problems, all kinds of problems. But God says, yes, that's where you started, but I want you to realize I'm going to make you a king. I'm going to make you a ruler over all the world. That's why we're here. Now, that's nothing new, is it? But your children will never have to experience some of the terrible things you experienced. And what about the next generation after that? What is it going to be like 500 years into the millennium? What is it going to be like then? You may have had an imperfect physical father, but the truth is you have a perfect father spiritually and a perfect husband, Jesus Christ. Perfect. And we can't, as I tell the students from time to time, we can't sit and mope about, look, okay, so you had a bad background. Welcome to the club. We all have come out of, well, not all of us, but many of us have come out of situations like that. I remember that we are here. God has to get us in that frame of mind, brethren, to do the work. I remember this minister that I had when I first came to the church and I was a deacon. And we all are going to have to learn to be shepherds like Jesus Christ. And so he would, when I tell the deacons and those on the visiting program, and when we have socials and dances and things like that, and if he'd see some of us standing around talking to each other, he'd come over and say, what are you doing? You're supposed to be out visiting with the people. Get to know the people and spend time with them and talk to them. Don't spend time here talking to each other. And that was good training for me, because I was always looking over my shoulder. Every time we had a social, I knew if I spent too much time with, let's say, the regular guys, he'd be coming. And I thought, well, that was wonderful training. I didn't resent that at all. But we're all going to have to reach out to each other, brethren, and the world that way. Christ said in John 10 that he is the great shepherd. The great shepherd, and we all need to be reaching out, as it says in the, well, John 21, I'll give you that scripture. I'm not going to turn it anymore. I don't have the time to do that. But we do all have to follow in the footsteps of our shepherd and get out and reach out to others in this world as much as we possibly can. As I mentioned to you before, when I went to that senior dinner that I had with Mr. Armstrong, truly one of the highlights of my life, that man came that night and he was sick. Sick. Now why would an old man who's sick get out and attend a senior lunch or dinner? What's the point? Why don't you stay home and take it easy and rest? Oh, you can find so much justification for doing that. But he came, and it was a highlight, one of the highlights of my life and the life of my wife, late wife. It was truly a highlight. And that's what God wants us to do for this world, brethren, is to really get out there and feed the lambs, as I've mentioned before, and the sheep. I'll just give you the scripture. John 21, verse 18, Christ said, I'm going to take you where you would not. I'm going to take you places that you wouldn't go. And that's exactly what he's going to do. Take us places that we would not go. I'll just conclude and read this poem quickly. I thought it was a pretty good poem that I read by A.S. Pushkin, a Russian. And in the title of it was The Prophet. Could be The King Priest or any title like that. Notice what he says, especially the conclusion. He said, "Parched with the Spirit's thirst, I crossed an endless desert sunk in gloom. And a six-winged seraph came where the tracks met, and I stood lost. Fingers light as dream he laid upon my lids. I opened wide my eagle eyes and gazed around. He laid his finger on my ears. And they were filled with roaring sound. I heard the music of the spheres. The flight of the angels through the skies, the beast that crept beneath the sea, the heady uprush of the vine, and like a lover kissing me, he rooted out the tongue of mine, fluent in lies and vanity." That old man, of course, no, I don't agree with every word of this, but you can see he's talking about he had some changing to do. "He tore my fainting," the poem continues, "he tore my fainting lips apart, and with his right hand steeped in blood, he armed me with a serpent's dart. With his bright sword, he split my breast. My heart leapt to him with a bound. A growing livid coal he pressed into the hollow of the wound. There in the desert I lay dead, and God called out to me and said, 'Rise, prophet, rise. Arise, king priest, rise, and hear and see, and let my works be seen and heard, and by all who turn aside from me, and burn them with my fiery word.'" That's what we're here for, is to burn this world with God's fiery word.